Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 88. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. As always, I'd like to begin by acknowledging and thanking the wonderful listeners who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. Your support is so very much appreciated. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website on thetudortrail.com or click the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. October's prize is a set of three Tudor-themed Christmas decorations designed by artist Catherine Holman. With Christmas just around the corner, you might like to check out ColouringTudorHistory.com for a range of gifts that will delight any Tudor history lover. Now, on to today's episode. Those of you who follow me on social media know that I'm absolutely obsessed with early modern portrait miniatures, which is why I'm so excited that joining me on the show to talk about these tiny masterpieces is portrait miniatures specialist Emma Rutherford. Emma began her career working in the Victoria and Albert Museum whilst completing an MA in Victorian Art and Architecture. She set up the Portrait Miniatures Department at Phillips Auctioneers, and after the amalgamation of Phillips and Bonham, she became Departmental Director. Emma has made several television appearances and advises the Antiques Roadshow. She has close working relationships with museum and gallery curators, conservators, and restorers. She's also conducted many significant private and public valuations and private treaty sales. Emma has written numerous articles for magazines and national newspapers and has also curated and co-curated many exhibitions of portrait miniatures at the Philip Mould Gallery, including Secret Faces and Jewel in the Hand, early portrait miniatures from private and noble collections. Among her significant discoveries, she recently uncovered a lost portrait miniature of Charles Dickens, now at the Charles Dickens Museum. My conversation with Emma straight after this short musical break. Today, I have a very special treat for you. The song you're about to hear is called Talk to the Ghosts, and it's from the new musical Boleyn. The music and lyrics are by the very talented Jessie Tomscoe, and the song is performed by Janie Brucey of Broadway's Jagged Little Pill. The song is written from the perspective of Catherine of Aragon in her final days. To find out more about this fantastic new musical, head to Instagram and search Boleyn Musical.
Cold nights on the moor, cold feet on the floor, and the winter's creeping in. My heart's heavy and sore, just silence at the door. You can hear the dropping of a pin. And the snow fell this morning, I felt it settle in my bones. Where a fire once was roaring, the cold has found a home. All I can do at best and most is talk to the ghosts in my head. One day I'll let them out and they'll surround me in the garden. Such fine company there'll be. children at last upon my knee. Till I'm the one remaining casualty of this war. It's another night on the moor. I remember a time filled with laughter and wine and fine friends in any storm. A man, my head in his hands, always glad to keep me warm. But the snow fell this morning, I felt it land inside my heart. Where a fire once was roaring, there's only cold and dark. All I can do at best and most is talk to
Welcome to Talking Tudors. Emma, how are you?
Thank you. I'm really well on a misty autumn morning in London.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. I thought a good place to start would be you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Emma Rutherford and my background is mainly in art history with some history thrown in. So at university, I studied art history and then I went to Royal Holloway and did a master's in Victorian art and architecture. So quite far away from the Tudors. And then I worked in the auction world after a short stint at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And I'm now a consultant at the Philip Mould Gallery in London. But I also do a lot of work for other institutions like National Trust, National Portrait Gallery. So it's a really nice varied work, but everything focuses on my very niche subject of portrait miniatures.
Yes, which I've become absolutely fascinated with of late, which is why I'm so excited to be talking to you. So could you tell us a little bit more about what your role actually involves?
Yeah, of course. So for the gallery specifically, we're basically always on the search for what we call sleepers, which are portrait miniatures or other works of art. It's the gallery's very focused on portraiture. So portrait miniatures obviously come under that remit really well. And sleepers are things which are paintings or miniatures which are miscatalogued by an auction house. So they either get the artist wrong or they don't know the artist. And the specialism in the gallery allows us to perhaps spot things that have been missed. And I like to think of myself as sort of rehabilitating these objects into either the public institutions or they go into private collections. So the next stage, once we've discovered something exciting, is to crack on with the research, which is probably my favourite part of the job. And I'm in archives, not at the moment, obviously, but that's where I spend a lot of my time. And I'm researching, I'm cataloguing, and then eventually, hopefully, we've got something, a portrait miniature, which has perhaps lost its identity, ready to be represented for sale, ultimately.
Fantastic. Sounds like, yeah, really interesting and varied job, definitely. We've mentioned this sort of term, portrait miniatures, and I'm sure people listening have heard that term used before. But what exactly is meant by this, Emma?
So portrait miniatures are often thought of as just sort of small variations of an oil painting, like an oil painting which has been shrunk to a portable size. But in fact, they've got a very, very specific history of their own. And the first sort of myth to bust, as it were, is the fact that the word miniature originally didn't refer to their size. It referred to the Latin word miniare, which means to colour with red lead. This goes back to their history, which is connected with manuscript illumination. So portrait miniatures evolve from the manuscript. And I think there's an art historian who once said, with courage and a pair of scissors, you could take a manuscript and create the first portrait miniature. So, which is a terrifying thought. But if you think about 16th century manuscripts, they often, within the first letter, which is usually very beautifully coloured and has touches of gold on it, there's sometimes a portrait incorporated into that first letter. And if the manuscript is something like a royal warrant, then that portrait is usually of the monarch, and it sort of embodied the monarch. It was as though the monarch was actually there, standing in at this moment of legality. And so the portrait in a manuscript has a lot of symbolic weight, and that symbolic weight then evolves, and the portrait of the monarch becomes taken out of the manuscript, and the first portrait miniature was born. So first miniaturists were not called miniaturists at all. They were called limners. You've probably heard that word. And the miniatures, the miniaturists were called limners, and the miniatures were called limnings. And this word limning derives from the word illuminata, to give light. And of course, you have illuminated manuscripts. And I always think it's a really beautiful way of describing these wonderful images, which are normally, again, a bit like miniatures, quite secretive. They're in books, so you have to sort of search for them, open the books, and you get that scale as well. So the first miniatures are painted on vellum, and they use exactly the same materials as illuminated manuscripts or early books.
Yeah, and as you're speaking, I'm flashing in my mind the different portraits that I've seen of, obviously, the Tudor monarchs done beautifully in those illuminated manuscripts as well. Yeah. Did these first appear during the 16th century, or are they a little bit earlier than that?
Funnily enough, I worked out recently that they're almost exactly 500 years old, because they first appear in the 1520s, and the earliest miniaturists are painted by two Netherlandish artists. In this country, in Britain, we had an artist called Lucas Hornbolt, and in France, the artist Jean Clouet. And they started sort of simultaneously, really, in England and France. So it depends whether you're British or French. You take your side. But it's interesting that the earliest miniatures really are of Henry VIII and his counterpart in France, Francis I. And they started using their artists, both of whom were involved with manuscript illumination, to present these standalone portraits of themselves.
And so what was their purpose to begin with?
Their purpose is really, on a fundamental level, to kind of reveal or conceal loyalty, which sounds like two things happening at once, which are complete opposites. But their uses in the very beginning were to as a real sort of show of power. So these fantastically valuable, carefully painted portraits of the monarch really revealed how they could capture the very best artistic ability in Europe. And then these miniatures would be exchanged between the two countries in a sort of power play. So they start at the very, very heart of the court. I was thinking about how I very first got interested in portrait miniatures. And I remember my parents taking me to Hever Castle when I was about 10 years old, and they had on display a miniature of Anne Boleyn. And I've no idea now whether that was an original or not, but it got me thinking. I was so into my history as a child, and it got me thinking, gosh, Henry VIII actually held this in his hand.
Yeah.
And it, for a child who wanted to sort of smell what the 16th century you know, really, really get involved in my history. The idea of someone like Henry VIII looking into this miniature in his hand and being the only one who could have a sort of relationship with it made me also think about the kind of romantic connotations of the miniature. And of course, it evolves from these very powerful, relatively formal portraits to something much more secretive and really goes to the heart of courtly life in terms of marriage negotiation and love affairs, which are of course all happening at the same time. So when I say conceal loyalty, the favourite place for ladies of the Tudor court to put their miniatures was between their breasts, tucked down in the bodice, and in large oil paintings, you quite often see this sort of black silk cord going down under the bodice. And we know that on the end of that black silk cord would be a portrait miniature tucked in. And you were revealing your loyalty probably to a lover by hiding your miniature there. So they're quite exciting things because they really allow you to see the secret life of the Tudors. I like the idea that when they were very first painted, they're only meant to be seen by three sets of eyes: the artist, the person who's commissioned the portrait, and the eventual recipient of the portrait miniature. So looking at them now, we're able, many, many years later, to see something that was initially only revealed to a very, very small circle of three people.
Yeah, so they're quite intimate objects, aren't they? They're absolutely quite amazing, yes.
Yeah,
And in terms of size, I just want to talk a little bit about the variation in sizes, because I recently saw a miniature of Elizabeth, and I knew they were small, but I was shocked at the size. This one was quite tiny. I can't remember the exact measurement now. But so what were the differences in sizes?
Well, again, I mean, a miniature can actually technically be any size. It doesn't have to be small, because the word miniature refers to the materials, which is vellum pasted onto some card and then painted in watercolor, exactly the same as illuminated manuscripts were constructed. But of course, because of their purpose, which we've just been talking about as kind of partially propaganda, but also partially of a romantic and secretive nature, they were small because they were something that you wanted to carry around with you. And you've probably seen as well that they're often housed in these incredible, well, if the frames exist, the original frames exist, they are in these incredible jeweled gold lockets. And so they were something that you were able to carry about your person. I kind of think of the equivalent now is probably the image that you've got on your iPhone.
Right, yes.
Yeah, phones have evolved to be something that we can carry on us at all times. And of course, when we take them out and look at them, the first thing we want to look at is an image of something or someone that we love. And miniatures worked in exactly the same way. So they needed to be small because you carried them around with you. So their size at this date in the 16th century is usually under 3 inches, but they do vary from some of them are only 1.5 inches up to something like the Young Man Among Roses, which I think must be around 4 inches high. So there is some variation, but not huge.
Okay, and so you've said that obviously they'd be worn, you know, close to the body, an intimate item. Were there any other uses for them? Would they have been displayed ever? Is there any evidence of that?
They are displayed a little bit later. There's a wonderful story of the Scottish ambassador visiting Elizabeth I, and she takes him right into her sort of inner sanctum, her bedroom, really, and shows him some miniatures that she has there. And obviously for Elizabeth, rather typically for Elizabeth, this is an astute political move, and she shows him a portrait of Mary, Queen of Scots, who obviously, right. But she also shows him one of Leicester, who, you know, she has this rather more special relationship with. And it's a real insight into how miniatures were kept, because he talks about them being shown in these little turned boxes, and they've got lids. So she's not wearing those. She's got a little collection, as it were, stored away that only she has access to. But if she allows, she will show them to favoured visitors. That's a really, really valuable insight into where they were kept. But they certainly weren't, in the Tudor period, hung on the wall for everyone to see. And their very size meant that they couldn't compete with a big oil painting that several people can stand around and comment on. If you showed someone your miniature, it was a real one-on-one experience. You have to hold them in your hand, and you can't be too far away from them, because, as you say, they're very intricately detailed. So they really are working in a very different sphere to any other type of portraiture at this period.
So wonderful to imagine Elizabeth holding her little miniature of Mary, Queen of Scots, and showing the ambassador. Only to be a fly on the wall that day, hey?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So what about the main materials and techniques used in the Tudor miniatures?
Yeah, so I've talked a little bit about this, but they were painted and constructed in a very, very specific way, and just with other art forms. There was a long apprenticeship involved, and I guess the generation after Hornbolt and Clouet, you get Hans Holbein working, and he's also working on lots of other different projects. So he's painting miniatures, but we know obviously he's designing all sorts of other things, and Henry VIII's using him for anything from architecture to costume design to armour design. So the first miniaturist who really concentrates just solely on painting miniatures is Nicholas Hilliard, who it really becomes Elizabeth I's image maker from the early 1570s. And it's clear she really trusts him to portray her exactly as she wants to portray, but in the form of a miniature, which is always thought to be a very truthful image. So luckily for us, Nicholas Hilliard wrote a treatise on how miniatures were painted, including the technique and also how your studio should be set up, and even down to what you should wear as a miniaturist.
Wonderful.
It's fantastic. So it's not just about how to get a bit of floppy vellum to stay on a piece of card. You use some starch, and you have to rub that down with an animal tooth attached to a stick, so there's no bumps in the vellum. There's a lot of preparation involved before you can then apply the first layer of paint. But he also talks about the fact that a miniaturist should only wear silk, because anything else, you might have fibres shedding onto the vellum and sticking to it, which obviously would be problematic. So there's a real wealth of information into exactly how miniatures were constructed. So although they're watercolour, which is very difficult to layer, the artist would initially paint something called a carnation, which is the skin tones, after very, very lightly, usually sketching out where the head of the sitter was going to be. And then the layers go on. You have this beautiful mid-16th century period onwards. You have this lovely blue background, which is very bright and connected with miniatures of this period. And then often you have an inscription, a lovely calligraphy inscription in gold. Hilliard, who also trained as a goldsmith, he even manages to construct jewels on this very, very tiny scale by putting a little blob of resin over a spot of silver paint. So that they're very, very three-dimensional if you put them under a raking light. And then, of course, you have the ruffs, which were sort of dribbled on in very thick white paint. So if you were to run your finger over one, which, of course, I would never advise, you would feel as though you were touching something like a doily or actual lace. They're so three-dimensional. So they're they're very, very carefully and specifically constructed.
Fabulous. And I've actually been embarrassed to say that I only recently discovered that they were laid onto a playing card, which I just found absolutely intriguing. So was it just done for practical reasons, or did the choice of suit and the card have actually a meaning connected to the sitter?
Well, this is something I've been musing on. I mean, I've been looking at miniatures for 25 years now, and I've always wondered, and it's always really, really exciting when you deconstruct a miniature, an early miniature, and you see this playing card on the back, because it's not only that you have this wonderful portrait of somebody from the period, you also get an insight into sort of Tudor leisure time.
Yes, that's right.
This playing card on the back. So I've always thought, and so have many of my fellow art historians, whether there's a connection. And bizarrely, literally about a week ago, somebody published an article, German art historian called Karin Leonard, in the British Art Studies Journal, which is online at the Paul Mellon Centre, on this exact point, whether there was there's a correspondence between these playing cards and who was portrayed on the miniature on the front. And she has discovered, by looking at lots and lots of miniatures, that there is a consistent pattern very, very early on. In fact, rather wonderfully, she calls her article Game of Thrones, because you can imagine the miniaturist having almost a bit of a secret joke to themselves, like they've got this deck of playing cards. Which playing card are they going to match up to the person that they're painting? And she found that the Ace of Diamonds early on is very much connected with royalty, and then the face card, kings, queens, jacks, were more distinguished court figures, and then hearts are often connected with marriage portraits. So often when people were betrothed is the time that you commission a portrait miniature, so that you're able to carry around a portrait of the person you're going to marry as a sort of part of the courtship. So that was so interesting to read her work on it, that it wasn't just completely random, the cleanest one, that there is a connection between the playing card and the sitter, which is very exciting.
It is. I love it. It's like a secret language embedded there.
Exactly. Which, of course, you know, they're full of anyway. But
absolutely, yeah.
You get this additional insight, which is just brilliant.
I'm just thinking, it's just astounding the work those artists did. So do we know roughly how long a miniature took to complete? And were they actually painted from life?
Yeah, so I think for me, one of the really, really exciting things is that Hilliard onward and Holbein really absolutely insisted that miniatures were always painted from life. So when I was talking about Hilliard's treatise, in that is a fantastic passage where he talks about meeting Elizabeth and her instructions to him that she doesn't want very much shadow. They're in a garden outside, so they're probably somewhere like Hampton Court. And it's just a fascinating insight into the fact that these miniaturists had access to the very, very inner sanctum of the royal court. But you also obviously get this very exciting idea that miniatures are not just copies of oil paintings. There is this strong tradition of having the sitter there. And we don't know exactly how many sittings. It's somewhere between 3 and 6 sittings. And in terms of expense, it's quite hard to find out, because you had the expense of the portrait miniature, but then you also had the expense of getting a jewelled frame made to enclose it. And if Elizabeth gave you her portrait miniature, which of course you would have been hugely honoured to receive a miniature of her, and it would have also had these sort of intimate connotations as well as it being an extremely important gift, but then you would have to commission a jewelled case to match the gift,
right, and yes. Sort of
reciprocal sort of thank you to her. So it's a little bit of a mystery, but we do know that the sitters were there. We know that they got to stop them from getting bored. Hilliard would have some soft music playing, and so you sort of imagine this sort of lutist in the corner.
Oh, it's wonderful. I think I need to read the treatise now, because it sounds incredible.
It's fantastic. His ego also comes through rather strongly, but, you know, that's all part of the fun.
Now, yeah. You've mentioned Hilliard, obviously, a few times. So who were the other most sought-after miniaturists of the day?
So I've also mentioned Holbein, who, of course, is incredibly important, and his portrait miniatures are just amazing, absolutely incredible. I'd always loved his drawings growing up, you know, again, they felt like a real insight into the real people of the court rather than these sort of formal, slightly removed oil paintings. But his miniatures are just absolutely exquisite, very, very exciting. So there's this very, very interesting name which comes up, which is Lavina Tierlink, who was a female artist who starts working in the very last year of Henry VIII's reign and then goes through and works for Edward, Mary and Elizabeth. So she works for four Tudor monarchs, and she's documented as giving New Year's gifts to Elizabeth. She's paid the same as Holbein, which is amazing.
Wow.
And she's a gentlewoman to Elizabeth, but she's also, her father, Simon Benning, was a very famous manuscript illuminator. And so she's obviously been trained by him. And so we know that she painted miniatures. And it's quite hard to connect the name with miniatures that actually exist. But there's a group of miniatures which have a very, very similar technique, which we think are by her. But it's really wonderful to think of a female artist producing miniatures at the same time. But it's a very small group of artists. So Hilliard trains up an artist called Isaac Oliver, who has a son called Peter Oliver. And so really you have Tierlink, Hilliard, and then the two Olivers dominating this relatively small art form in all ways at the time.
So it sounds obviously quite exclusive. So is this only something that obviously the nobility and royalty of the time could afford, or were other people's commissioning miniatures as well?
Well, again, this is a really interesting and exciting aspect for me about miniatures. I mean, certainly they were very, very important and central to court life, and they certainly start at very much at the centre of the court in England with Henry VIII. But Hilliard, despite all his big ego and his big claims, was always in financial difficulty. So very, very excitingly, he also took commissions from the more ordinary folk of London. So you do get fantastic miniatures of merchants and their wives, of Hilliard's own wife, and that's another wonderful insight into Tudor life, that you get these very intimate portraits of more ordinary people. In some respects, miniatures they cover quite a wide demographic, but in other respects, they're very, very much central to the royal court.
And Emma, I don't know if you can answer this sort of off the top of your head, but with artists like Holbein and other court artists, were they paid a salary and they just did the work, whatever work was required of them, or were they paid for each separate piece of art that they produced?
I'm not 100% sure about this, but certainly they were given a sort of royal payment per annum. And I would imagine that there was an agreement that they would produce a certain number. We know that they were very much in demand and often behind on their commissions, but I don't think it necessarily stopped them from being able to take on other work outside the court.
And what is your favourite 16th century miniature?
Oh,
it's a tricky one, isn't it? There's so many incredible ones.
That is tricky. So I would say probably it has to be Holbein's 1539 portrait of Anne of Cleves, because I think for this tiny, tiny miniature, I mean, literally a few centimetres of paint, I think this miniature might well have changed the course of history. We know that Holbein was sent to paint Anne of Cleves prior to Henry marrying her. And I think this goes back to the point of actually having the sitter in front of you. So Holbein went to Anne of Cleves and painted her. And of course, because of the miniature's size, because it's watercolour, it dries very quickly. It could have been cased within a day and then sent back to Henry. So this is Henry's first glimpse of his new wife, wife-to-be, which is incredibly exciting. And I think when you look at other portraits of Anne of Cleves, and you obviously know what happened, that Henry, very quickly realised that that this marriage was not going to be a success on any level. You realise how important this tiny little portrait was in the decision making of Henry. And Holbein has really captured Anne's features perfectly and accurately, but he's done a few clever things. He's he's framed her slightly wider face in a headdress, and she's looking straight out at Henry, at the viewer, with her slightly sleepy eyes. But the headdress has very much sort of framed her face rather beautifully and slightly flattened her nose, which we know was quite sort of bulbous. So Holbein has captured her features very accurately, but he's chosen a view which I think he knew Henry might have liked.
Yes.
So I think that's, I mean, as a portrait, it's just absolutely beautiful. But I just like the idea that this tiny little thing that could have fitted in Henry's hand changed the course of history.
Yes, it's incredible. And I'm just imagining, obviously, you know, very tall and large Henry holding this tiny thing in his hand and obviously looking at it quite closely.
Yeah.
And incredible that we still have it. That is quite mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely.
All right, Emma, this has been so wonderful. I'm absolutely totally in love with these miniatures at the moment. So this has been so wonderful to chat with you. Now, sure. At the end of the episodes, what I like to do just to get to know our guests a little bit better, we play a little game of 10 to go. So just 10 quick questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for that?
I think I am.
All easy, don't worry. All right. So what was the last book that you bought?
Oh gosh. So, well, nonfiction, really boringly. It was probably Elizabeth Goldring's recent biography of Nicholas Hilliard.
Oh, okay. That sounds good.
Called Life of an Artist, which manages to be incredibly readable as well as amazingly well researched. So it's not just about miniatures, it's really about Tudor life and about a young man born in Exeter with the incredible talent who sort of makes it right into the centre of the court from relatively humble beginnings. So it's a cracking read.
Oh, fantastic. Well, there you go. I think I'm going to have to purchase it now. You've sold it to me, so that sounds good. What is your favourite comfort food?
Oh, my gosh. I wish I'd had forewarning of these comfort food. Well, this morning it was definitely my porridge.
Yes.
Looking out onto misty Richmond Park and thinking about my run, which I was dreading at that time. Once I had the porridge in me, I was up and ready to go.
You were so ready to go. Yes, because it's getting quite chilly there now.
It is, yeah.
Oh, lovely. And what about a treasured or just a favourite childhood memory?
Well, my poor parents, I mean, I really did drag them probably to every National Trust house in the country virtually. So I have some very funny memories of my brother literally refusing to set foot in any historical mansion and sort of skulking and sulking outside while I went in with my parents. And I think really sadly, those are probably my favourite childhood memories.
I love that, because normally people say that their parents dragged them around to all the properties. You know, that's what people, and I love that it was you dragging your parents. That's fantastic. And obviously we're not doing too much holidaying at the moment, but if things were kind of normal, what is a favourite holiday destination for you?
I would have to, I mean, I'm so lucky living in London that we can take the Eurostar and get really far. I don't like flying, so I love the Eurostar and probably the south of France, particularly at the moment. Oh, the idea of that sort of warm sun and would be wonderful.
That's a special place, isn't it?
Light.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, do you have, I don't know if you're a cook, but do you have a signature recipe?
My signature recipe is to order food and see my family breathe a sigh of relief.
That's good. I like that. I haven't had that response before. And do you have any pets?
Yes, I have a huge golden retriever called Maple, who is about an opposite to a miniature in that she right now she's very wet and muddy and she's great fun. She smiles, so I spend my whole life saying to people, she's smiling, she doesn't want to kill you. So she's a great character, but she's, very messy and large.
Yeah, they do get quite big, I know, because they're such little tiny puppies and then this huge dog.
No one tells you how big they get.
Exactly. What would be an ideal Sunday morning for you?
Oh, well, I hope my family's listening, because, yes, I would like that cup of tea in bed.
Yes.
But that never happens. And probably quite a slow get up, and then by 10 o'clock in the park with the dog for a really good walk would be ideal. Yeah.
And obviously you live in London, so you've got lots of incredible places to visit nearby. But what's one of your favourite or most sort of inspirational places that you like to visit?
I do love the Wallace Collection in London, because obviously that's a house where the treasures have sort of never left. So it's a like a very fancy Miss Havisham type scenario. Lots of gilding, and you know, they were great. The Hartford family were great Francophiles, so they have an incredible collection of French portrait miniatures with a few English gems in there as well. But it just feels like stepping into just a really grand house where they had fantastic parties, but there's also all these incredible treasures around, and a very good cafe as well. So
good tip. Excellent.
Yeah,
fantastic. And what's one of the best or most memorable gifts that you've received?
That's a good question. So my husband and I recently had our 20th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And he's a photographer, and as a wonderful gift for me, he mocked up one of my favourite Elizabethan portrait miniatures and superimposed his head.
that's so great.
It was just wonderful, a complete surprise, great work in Photoshop, and I absolutely love it, because I can then pretend I'm a Tudor lady receiving this secret miniature.
I love it. I think he could sell those, couldn't he? And we could all be Tudor.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was a really, really lovely surprise, and came with a beautiful gem present as well. But that was fantastic, the work that had gone into that.
Oh, that does sound fantastic. And every other husband now really has to lift their socks up. all right. And lucky last, a little word association one. So the first word that comes to mind when you hear the name Elizabeth the First.
Well, I mean, you know, because I'm talking miniatures, obviously, I'm just thinking back to Hilliard's first miniature of her, which I think is 1572. And, you know, they're both young and going places. And there's something about this miniature that just sparks. It's just fantastic. And she's in all her finery, but there's a slightly more relaxed air to it than there are to the later miniatures, which are slightly more formal. So I love that. And the first meeting of these two and their relationship, which progressed over many years. What their first conversation would have been. So I'm afraid it's miniature related.
I love that. That's really wonderful. And the very last thing that I ask my guests is for a Tudor takeaway. So this is just a little gem for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode. It could be a book that you recommend, a website, you know, an online gallery to look at. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Well, I think with miniatures, the thing is that they're so difficult to appreciate unless you can actually hold one in your hand and get a really good magnifying glass on it and really study this incredible work, which today I don't know how they produce these exquisite miniatures. So I would say get on any decent website where they've got early miniatures. So the National Collection here is at the Victoria and Albert Museum. There's fantastic miniatures at the National Portrait Gallery. But most national galleries do have a few early miniatures. And just use their magnifying tool to really take yourself around the miniature. Look at the layering, the clever techniques. I just think that would be my top tip. If you've enjoyed listening to how these tiny things were constructed, how despite their size, they were so important in Tudor history, and just get lost in looking really close up at an early miniature.
Which is exactly what I'm going to do after this episode, because I'm just obsessed with them at the moment. Emma, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Very fun and very informative. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk Tudors with me.
No problem. It's been great fun. Anytime. I love talking miniatures, particularly Tudor miniatures.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other tutor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tutor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking tutors with you again very soon.